Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from James Madison. I believe there are more instances of the abridgment of the freedom of the people by gradual and silent encroachments of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations. Coming up on today's program, John Drury will be here to say there's a rush to corporate success and empty promises. Colleen Kelly with the IRS, actually the IRS watch, is going to be telling, she's actually an employee, a National Treasury Employees Union, about what's going on with the IRS, some interesting stuff. And right now, Sam Kasman with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, their website is with us. Sam, welcome to the program.
Hi, good afternoon.
Great to have you with us, Sam. You guys at the Competitive Enterprise Institute have, you know, very pro-business tilt, usually, and if I'm reading...
Well, we've got a pro-market tilt, which I think translates into pro-consumer, but go ahead.
All right. Well, okay. Reading this piece, FDA too slow to approve new drugs and medical devices, April 3rd, well, actually, this is an older piece, but I'm wondering why you want to take us back to a time. I mean, you go back to the 1920s when people literally died from cosmetics. In fact, it was the death of about 100 people from a cosmetic product that led to, finally, Congress to give rulemaking, you know, actual power to the Food and Drug Administration. Why do you want to roll this stuff back?
Look, I think there's no question that products occasionally kill people, but I think one big problem today is that FDA kills people, namely because a number of very important new therapies end up being delayed because of the Food and Drug Administration.
This was the Massengill Company. I mean, they're still around, and in 1937...
Yeah,
100 people died from this stuff.
Right, and it was not a cosmetic. It was actually a cold remedy.
Yeah, it was an elixir.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one big question there is why Massengill could not be hammered into bankruptcy under existing common law, because they were basically selling poison. They had mixed this drug with a certain type of alcohol. And they
diethylene glycol.
Testing, and I just don't know what in common law prevented them from being hammered to death, as they should have been, but they did get by. But I think what you've got now is an agency which suffers from what we call deadly overcaution. That is, it is becoming incredibly scared of approving anything, no matter of what life-saving potential it's got, if there's a risk that they just don't know everything about it now and there are going to be some adverse consequences later. And I'd be glad to get into examples with you.
But see, here's the problem with your approach, Sam, Sam Kasman with CEI.org, is that if Massengill was hammered into bankruptcy, to use your phrase, that's still an after-the-fact solution. You still have 100 people who are dead. Having the FDA have the power to require that pharmaceutical companies demonstrate efficacy and safety. And granted, it's a process that still, I mean, you know, Vioxx slipped through, thalidomide slipped through.
Yeah, well,
I mean, a lot of things have slipped through.
The story on Vioxx is not closed. I mean, Merck has gone to court 8 times and it's won 5 cases. So I think that's an open question. But let me give you a much more recent example. 2 months ago, FDA finally approved a drug called Tysabri, which produces some tremendous improvements in people suffering from multiple sclerosis. And it took them 9 months to do that. And one question has got to be, you know, if this drug is going to start saving people once it's approved, how many MS sufferers died waiting for FDA to approve it? How are you going to make those people whole?
Well, how are you going to make whole the people who might have died from other MS remedies that would have been put on the market without the FDA having tested them for safety and efficacy if there was no federal regulatory system?
I don't think anyone would have, because I think...
Only products that are going to be absolutely perfect are going to be brought to market?
No, but remember, people don't grab this stuff off the shelf. They go through their physicians, and physicians usually have to have a good reason for prescribing one thing over another. The data in favor of Tysabri were excellent. The problem was there was a 1 in 1,000 chance at most of MS sufferers contracting a certain type of immune disease that might kill them. It turned out 55% of all MS sufferers wanted to have that drug. They were more than willing to take that risk. And the problem is when you get an agency suffering from this deadly overcaution problem, you're denying that to them. And frankly, you know, I would not abolish the agency. I wouldn't even change its standards for safety and effectiveness. I would just turn it into an advisory agency which can't veto stuff, which just puts out the word on whether it thinks something is good or bad.
Just get rid of all its power. But Sam, you can't mean to tell me, we're talking with Sam Kasman, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. I think I just heard you say that doctors are well informed. You can't be naive enough to believe that doctors are getting their information from sources primarily other than the pharmaceutical companies. I mean, even most of the research in the United States has been so contaminated by the pharmaceutical companies that the Journal of the American Medical Association had to drop their standard of requiring people to disclose everything, National Academy of Sciences. Pardon?
I
mean, you can't find people who aren't you can't find research that's not contaminated by drug companies.
Well, contamination, this is a nonsense notion. I think there's a huge problem if you take the profit motive out of pharmaceutical research, because what you end up with is the equivalent of a government postal service.
No, you end up with research that is designed to cure disease rather than to make money.
Postal service provides, you know, pure nonsense, nothing.
The Postal Service delivers the mail, Sam.
What?
The Postal Service delivers the mail.
And if the Postal Service was in charge of drug development, it would be delivering new drugs even more slowly. So frankly, I'll take my risks with the pharmaceutical industry driven by profit rather than with the Postal Service, which is immune to everything. Now, let's go back to doctors.
I would submit to you, Sam, that if the Postal Service was if the pharmaceutical industries were run like the Postal Service, the drugs would cost a whole lot less. And on the other hand, if the Postal Service was made a for-profit enterprise, it wouldn't cost 35 cents to 37 cents to send a letter across the United States.
You remember that show, The West Wing, right? A pretty liberal show. They had one neat comment once about FDA, which was that if FDA had been in charge of polio therapies, we would have the best iron lung in the world, and we would never have had a vaccine for polio. And I think that's even more true.
You're getting your talking points from a TV drama.
Where are you getting your talking points here? I mean,
from common sense.
Why do you talk about contamination by profit?
From the history of people who have died as a result of the FDA not having the powers that you want to take away from them now.
I'm telling you, more people have died because FDA has been delaying therapies and have died because certain drugs have had to turn out to have side effects that weren't anticipated.
As of March 2006, over 10,000 cases and 190 class actions have been filed just against Merck. I mean, this is just the stuff that slips through the
like
cracks.
I said,
you want to turn those cracks into a crevasse.
You had 8 cases go to trial
so
and
far.
Verdict in Merck, and
so
Merck
far.
Has won 5 of them. So I don't think that story is really closed. But the point is, you never hear in the press about people who suffer and die because they did not have access to a therapy that was bottled.
Sam,
how many cases have been filed on behalf of MS sufferers because they could not get hold of Tysabri? Not a single one.
If we went to the world that you're describing, how many people would have died because of the 20 or 30 different MS therapies that were on the market because nobody was regulating them and checking them out? They're not there because the FDA exists.
No, they're not there because no doctor in his right mind would have gone to them.
But the doctors are getting the information from the drug companies, and the drug companies have a long history of not behaving ethically.
Doctors know they have to go through this information with their own judgment. And, yeah, if one company is puffing some bogus remedy, lots of other companies are going to be in there very quickly deflating that.
Oh, right? Come on. These are the drug companies that sing and dance together so efficiently that they get our Medicare laws rewritten.
You know, the point to remember is this. If a drug gets approved, no one is forced to use it. If a drug is unapproved by FDA, everyone is prevented from using it. So there's no moral equivalence here between the two. And you have therapies that are still being bottled up at FDA, and once they get approved, you've got to be asking the question, which I bet you, Tom, have never asked on your show, namely, if this therapy is going to save lives tomorrow, how many people died yesterday waiting for FDA to act?
Well, because while FDA was acting, it was making sure that a lot of other people didn't die from another drug that could have killed people, another thalidomide, another Vioxx, that they're preventing from getting on the market. I mean, you can't present one side of the argument without the other side.
That is the one side of the story that always gets the press headlines and always gets your headlines, and that other side of people dying while they wait just never makes the news. And it's for that reason the FDA is always going to err on the side of making extra sure.
On
which
the side
sounds
of caution.
Great. But, you know, if you're drowning because you've got a chronic disease, a terminal disease, and there's no adequate therapy, you ought to be entitled to take risks.
Even if it'll kill you?
It's your decision to make. You know, that disease is going to kill you in any case.
As if we're all pharmaceutical researchers.
No, we know where to find them.
Sam Kasman, CEI.org, the website, Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sam, thanks for being with us today. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
You've got a headache. Now I've got some strange disease. Don't worry about it. This pill will set your mind at ease. It's called Progenitorivox. It's made by Squab Merlco. It's a life-enhancing miracle. But there are some things you should know.
It may cause agitation, palpitations, excessive salivation, constipation, male lactation, rust-colored urination, hallucinations, bad vibrations, mild electric shock sensations. But it's worth it for the drugs I need.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense in the radical middle. Here's what it comes down to. Do you believe the government should play a role as the representative of we the people in protecting and defending we the people, or do you believe that we the people should be on our own? Free to make our own choices and free to die as a consequence of them if we're not sufficiently well-informed. And that's, in many ways, actually a legitimate debate. I mean, I would say, I don't want to put words in Sam's mouth. He's not here to defend himself. But I would say that, by and large, that's where this thing cleaves down to. And it's a matter of philosophy and ideology. As Bill Clinton said in Seattle a couple of weeks ago, this is the fundraiser for Congressman Jim McDermott, one of the best guys in Congress. And I was the MC for this fundraiser, and Bill Clinton kind of laid this stuff out.
Because there really is a huge sort of philosophical difference between the two parties, deeply held, that has policy and political implications and produces very different results for the American people.
And it's the stuff we were just talking about. Here he continues.
They honestly believe the source of America's greatness is in its big companies and wealthy elite. And we believe the source of America's greatness is in its middle class and the promise that everybody who works can be rewarded for it. And they, therefore, their primary goal when they get political power is to literally to concentrate wealth and power. And that's what they believe they should do. And so to them, there's nothing at all wrong with running these kind of unbelievable crony capitalist operations they run. All these no-bid contracts and missing money in Iraq and having by far, even more than in the Reagan years, the largest number of people in charge of health and environmental regulations coming right out of the industries they were supposed to regulate. Because it concentrates wealth and power. There was nothing wrong in ballooning the cost of the Medicare drug program and having it written so that only Albert Einstein had a big enough brain to understand it, because they had to cut in the drug companies and the insurance companies because that's what they do, transfer middle-class people's tax money to them and make it the only program that we now, it's the only big purchasing program for pharmaceuticals anywhere in America where the purchaser is by law prohibited from bargaining for lower prices for big volume purchases. The VA hospital does it, General Motors does it, every large employer does it. Only you as a taxpayer can't do it because that's not what the providers and the insurers want. But that's what they believe they should do, to concentrate wealth and power.
And that's ultimately what it comes down to. I mean, that's, you know, just very simply. By the way, what makes today a very, very significant day? Yes, today we have been in Iraq. One day longer than it took us to defeat Hitler. I kid you not. One day longer than it took us to defeat Hitler. Now, some of you may be old enough to remember this from back in the days when this was a hit song, although this isn't the version. What was it, Tommy Dorsey or something? Maybe somebody in the chat room knows the Never Say Never song from the 30s and 40s.
Just the thing I say I'd never do.
It's a big hit.
I walked away and said goodbye. I was hasty, wasn't I? I missed you so I thought I'd die.
But this is a version that was done by the Nazis and broadcast into England as they were dropping bombs on England. That was a real war.
Here is a new version sent to us by a disillusioned Englishman. We'll never say never again. Cause here we are at war again. Up to our necks in war again with you. We'll never say never fight wars again. Cause here we are at war again. It's just a thing that Churchill made us do.
It's all Churchill's fault, don't you get it?
We thought to war we'd say goodbye. Cause war ain't fun and that's no lie. We like to live and we hate to die. But it's all up now and that too is no lie. We'll never say never again. Cause here we are at war again. Up to our necks in war again. And we can't pull through.
There you go. That was an old Nazi propaganda song that was being broadcast into England as the bombing was beginning. And we defeated Hitler in less time than we have been in Iraq as of today. 1,245 days, I believe. Yeah, 1,245 days it took us to defeat Hitler. And it's been 1,246 days since we invaded Iraq. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. Remember this? By the time we got to Woodstock. Keep that playing there for a second. Today, in 1969, was Woodstock. And I couldn't go because I was working at a radio station. And I was low man on the totem pole. It was WVIC, AM and FM in Lansing, Michigan, as I recall. And we were playing good chunks of Woodstock live. And I was the guy sitting there playing the switch, and all the other, not all the other guys, but the guys who were higher up in seniority and got to, you know, get a week off. They went to Woodstock, and I was, anyhow, I remember it well, auditorily. It was a fine thing. Today, Woodstock, today also, the day after, well, today's also VJ Day, Victory in Japan Day. Yesterday, today, depending on how you look at it, it was one day in the United States. It was yesterday in Japan. And that's, of course, where the surrender happened. So generally we celebrate it yesterday. But it just brings up the point that yesterday was also, and today now, one day longer than VE, you know, the time from Pearl Harbor to VE Day, from the time Germany declared war on us until the time that Hitler has committed suicide and we took Berlin, and that was the end of Germany. By the way, back to our discussion about the FDA, I just wanted to point out the story that was in the media, it was about 2 weeks ago or so. We did it here on this program, a medical story in the Science News, about how they're now concerned that ultrasound may have previously unknown effects. I told the story when this first came out about how when I was a kid, I used to walk into this. I was on the way home from school. I'd walk into the shoe store, and they used to let us go over and stick our feet in the machine, the X-ray machine that you could use to see if your shoes fit. It was a big fad in 1958 or something like that. And so we'd stick our feet in there and wiggle our toes, and we'd look at the bones in our feet. And it's so cool. I know what the bones in all my feet look like, in both my feet. And I've seen them many times. God only knows how many X-rays I've had there. And then they figured out, hey, this causes cancer. This isn't a good thing. So, and then we hear, you know, Tom Cruise buys an ultrasound machine for Katie. Maybe that's why they're not showing the baby to the world. I don't know. Maybe it got ultrasounded one time too many. But what they found is that with rats, and now they're trying to replicate these studies with monkeys, with rats, that the ultrasound on the very, very young animals seems to change the way their brains work. And there's virtually not a baby born in the United States right now that hasn't had ultrasound. None of my three kids did. I mean, it was not a big thing 30 years ago, even 20 years ago. But at least I don't think any of our three. It's possible our third one did. But now it's just absolutely routine at a whole series of stages of fetal development. And questions being raised. Is this cooking kids' brains? Could this be? Could it be ultrasound and not mercury in the vaccines that's causing this explosion of autism, for example, in the United States? Nobody knows. Nobody knows. But should we have an agency that overlooks this, that regulates this, that does research into this, that holds companies accountable? I think so. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 866-440-8466. TomHartmann.com, of course, our website. If you want to drop into our live chat room, drop in and say hi. Bob in Clifton, Tennessee on the line. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Just as an aside, I was also at a radio station just before Woodstock.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and we were invaded by some very pro-Vietnam War people, and they put me in the hospital.
Oh, my goodness.
So I couldn't go to the Woodstock either.
So you and I are of the same era, and we're both old radio rats.
That's right, and I would like to... I disagree with you about the pharmaceutical companies, but I'd first like to preface that. I'm in the middle of your wonderful book, very painful book, Unequal Protection.
Hmm.
I really enjoyed the book that you wrote on The Last Days of Ancient Sunlight.
Being last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, huh?
Yes, being an anthropologist, and I was inspired by What Would Jefferson Do? But I find this book just painful.
Well, read it all the way to the end, because the last third of it is a very clear call to action, and it's telling you about what people all around the country are doing to solve the problem. So that book has a pretty good ending.
It's a wonderfully written book and full of great information. I truly recommend it.
Well, thank you, Bob.
But I would like to say about the pharmaceutical company, first of all, several points. I feel as if I'm treated as a child, needing to bring a note home from mommy to school when I missed, when I have to go to the doctor and get a prescription.
Mm-hmm.
There are many pharmaceuticals, such as antibiotics, where I've had an illness, I recognize the symptoms, and I could, without a $35, $40 doctor visit, be self-medicating.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you on that, Bob. I mean, I've been in countries. I was the last time I was in India, in fact, I got sick and I walked into a pharmacy and just over the counter I was able to get an antibiotic and knock out the, you know, whatever it was that was taking out my stomach. Down in Mexico, I guess they sell, you know, from what I've heard, I've never tried to buy it down there, but I understand that some of the benzo drugs like Valium are over the counter and codeine is over the counter in Canada, and in the United Kingdom, you can actually buy morphine over the counter in the form of an anti-diarrhea medication. I think that we are way too restrictive in the United States on what's available. That is to say, what you have to go to a doctor to get. But nonetheless, if I'm buying a pharmaceutical, because I'm not a pharmaceutical scientist, I can't test every product that I buy for purity and for efficacy to make sure that it's actually effective and to make sure it's not going to harm me. I think that there should be an agency that's making sure that my food is safe and that's making sure that my drugs are safe.
Well, I agree with you, and I certainly agree that there should be meat inspection and things of that sort. But at the same time, when we talk about liberty, we should have the liberty to ingest, to eat, whatever we wish. The government shouldn't have the right to be able to say no meat on Friday.
I agree. I think, Bob, we're both kind of dancing around the appropriate end of the libertarian perspective, and that is that, you know, for example, I don't think that there should be any laws against any drugs that are natural substances. Period. Yeah, but the problem is that in the old days when you lived in a small town or a small community and people knew and things were fairly simple and you knew what was going on. Like when I lived in Montpelier, Vermont, I mean, you know, there was a bad doctor in Montpelier. I mean, this is a true story. This was like five, six years ago when I was living in Vermont. And this guy had like harmed a couple of people. The word spread. Everybody knew. This guy, he couldn't get patients. I mean, he ended up being prosecuted. But the fact of the matter is that word travels in a little town. If that guy had gone to New York City, he could have maimed thousands of people. So I think that at a certain level, us getting together and saying, you know, we're going to protect us from the predators among us, whether those predators be pharmaceutical companies like Massengill back in the 1930s selling this cold remedy that actually contained diethylene glycol. It was killed 100 people, or whether it's, you know, an incompetent doctor. I think that there's some reason for that regulation that's useful.
Well, I agree to a certain extent, but I think the education department should be educating us about such things instead of stupid things like No Child Left Behind.
Okay, I'll go with you on that.
And there should be an FDA that requires certain things, and I think we should be getting a return as citizens for our investment in the investigations and development of many of these pharmaceuticals that are just given away to these corporations.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree with you there. The primary research that leads to pharmaceuticals is paid for by government agencies or funded by government, and this is another example of the pharmaceutical companies doing what so many other companies do, and that's internalized profits, externalized costs. And we're picking up. But then you could argue the flip side of that is we are getting a benefit in as much as we know when we take a drug, to the extent that it's possible to know what the side effects, what the potential side effects are, what the dangers are, and what the potential upside is.
But with the reporting that is required for occurrence of disease or problems with pharmaceuticals and things, people could be notified of potential dangers or actual dangers.
But then what are you going to do, Bob? What are you going to do, Bob, if the pharmaceutical companies come out and start hyping this stuff? They're advertising it.
Well,
I mean, we're not talking about breakfast cereal here. We're talking about things that can cause long-term damage. You know, it's like these Lipitor, for example, has some serious side effects. And if the drug companies didn't let you know about that, I mean, not to pick on one particular drug. I know somebody who got one of the side effects. Well, what do you do?
Well, I think it's a case of education.
Okay. All righty. Well, we'll agree to disagree then. Bob, I appreciate the call. Thank you very much for tuning in and for phoning up. Our number 1-866-440-8466. TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. We'll be back with your calls and a little more. We figured out, I think, why these guys had these cell phones in Michigan right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the pill that will help you escape the matrix. Speaking of pills, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 1-866-440-8466, our phone number, Sarah in Plantation, Florida on the line. Hey, Sarah, what's on your mind today?
Hi, actually, I just want to make a couple comments about the whole ultrasound issue.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an ultrasound technologist, and, you know, we do try to use low frequencies on the babies.
Mm-hmm.
But
you mean low intensities?
Frequencies, it's the power, pretty much, that we give to the baby. I'll tell you what, the babies really do respond to the ultrasound. They move a lot more once you start the scan.
Well,
and always said, I wonder if they're hearing something, feeling something.
Well, what the article said was that there was evidence of damage caused by heat in the brains of rat pups at ultrasound levels that were similar to those used on humans, although the ultrasounds were passing through less tissue in the rats. So, you know, there is that. But they were concerned. The concern is that there may be a heating effect that is causing neurological damage or changes. And they found that the brains of rats, the rat pups, after they were born, they autopsied them, and they found that the brains of rat pups that had been subjected to a number of ultrasounds were actually physically different in small but measurable ways from those that had not been subject to ultrasound. So,
well, just remember, they use high-intensity frequencies for, like, physical therapy and muscle tissue and stuff like that.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. But so, I still think ultrasound's important in diagnosing, you know, fatal diseases. And
oh, sure. And so are x-rays, and we know that x-rays cause cancer.
I take my job so seriously.
Yeah.
But I do want to say one more thing. Some of these doctors, you'd be amazed how many ultrasounds they send the patients in for. There are some patients on bed rest there in the hospital that get daily scans.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's spooky. Here's the actual story. This exposure to ultrasound can affect fetal brain development in mice. A study reported in today's editions of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences suggests when pregnant mice were exposed to ultrasound, a small number of nerve cells in the developing brains of their fetuses failed to extend correctly into the cerebral cortex. But the findings should not discourage pregnant women from having ultrasound scans for medical reasons, said lead researcher Pasco Ratchich, chairman of the neurobiology department at Yale University School of Medicine. However, he said women should avoid unnecessary ultrasound scans until more research has been done.
Yes. And I mean, you look at all these 3D and 4D clinics that are opening up. You know,
oh, yeah. Tom Cruise bought one for Katie, right? Let's ultrasound the baby every day and see how it's doing.
That's ridiculous. And that's why California passed that Tom bill.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, and that's, do not have these medical licenses to do the things, should not have these things.
Yeah, there you go. Sarah, thank you very much. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for the insight and for the thoughts and good point. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Julian, before we get to the FDA stuff that you called about, I just want to tell you, because I know in Michigan there's all this hysteria about the Mackinac Bridge being blown up because these guys had 1,000 cell phones.
Yes.
Well, here's this is interesting. Mike Newman, vice president of RE Cellular Inc. in Dexter, says certain companies will sell prepaid telephones at a loss because the phones are programmed so that they can only be used with a particular company's telephone calling card. So this is sort of like these prepaid cell phones are sort of like, you know, the printer companies will sell printers at cost or at a loss because they know that they're going to make money from you because you're going to have to buy the ink cartridges at inflated prices.
Yeah.
So they sell the phones at a loss, knowing that they're going to make their money on the calling cards. Well, he says he's heard of a possibly illegal scheme involving middlemen who know how to unlock the software on the phones so that the phones are no longer dependent on one company's calling cards. And so people go in and they bulk purchase these phones. This is why Walmart limits phone sales to 3 phones per transaction, is at their manufacturer's request, so that people who know how to hack the software in the phones so that they can use other phone companies' credit cards can't get 1,000 phones and resell them. So apparently, you know, the government, the police in Michigan, everybody's all hysterical about this, thinking that these guys, because they happen to be Middle Eastern, had some connection with terrorism. In fact, what they were doing was one of these hustles, apparently.
Yes, there was a story in the Grand Rapids Press today about that. I did not read the details, but apparently the case will be dismissed.
Yeah, okay. Well, I thought I was telling you something you didn't know. Oh, well.
Maybe if I'd read it, it would have had all
there
this.
You go.
I don't know.
But you called about the FDA. What's up?
Yeah, I'm curious. My guess is that the FDA probably makes for extenuating circumstances like people dying in order to terminate.
They actually do. My father had a type of cancer that is so incredibly fatal that there's just like no therapy for it at all. They opened him up. They said that's it, and they closed him back up and said go home and make out your will. And it's a mesothelioma. It's caused by exposure to asbestos. And there is an experimental drug right now available for mesothelioma. And if he had wanted to, he could have gotten into a trial for it, even though the drug has not been approved. If his doctor had been willing to fill out the paperwork, he could have gotten it. And he could have gotten it very cheap, in fact. We don't know yet whether it would have done him any good. And he died in the meantime. But, these are the clinical trials. Yeah. There are ways to get in, to get around that if you're dying. Yep. Good point.
Okay.
Julian, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Ed in Linwood, Washington. Hey, Ed, we have a little less than a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to make my comment and then let you speak on it because you're so eloquent. I was hoping you knew something about this new drug, ketamine. I had heard something about it. I don't know. I'm not exactly sure now.
Ketamine is an old drug. Are you talking about the drug that essentially paralyzes you?
Yeah, well, apparently now they're marketing it for antidepression, and one of the side effects was hallucinations.
Yeah, well, ketamine, when I was a kid 30 years ago, people were shooting ketamine to get high. I mean, because and it's dangerous stuff. I mean, people died from it.
Well, apparently the pharmaceutical companies have a handle on that.
Oh, man.
Thank you.
Amazing. Yeah, thanks a lot, Ed. No, I know a guy who was very into ketamine, and it was not pretty what happened to him. I mean, it was, I don't know, maybe he was always a zombie, but no, bad stuff. Anyhow, we're gonna move right along here. Colleen Kelly is going to be with us in the third hour of our program. Next hour, we've got a whole pile of news to get through, plus your phone calls, 866-440-8466. We'll be back. It's Tom Hartman Radio Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. What's the real federal deficit? Is the Bush administration setting us up for never-ending war? Today, one day longer than the time it took us to defeat Hitler in Germany. Have we been in Iraq? Amazing. I don't know how to go beyond this. It's just amazing. On top of this, voter suppression now is sweeping the nation. Salon has a piece, an article about how in six states, Republicans are making it harder and harder for people to vote. And I mean, just, what are the six states where the election's going to be stolen this time? Well, they're figuring it out. As Paul Weyrich, the conservative theocrat, dominionist, mastermind behind much of the Republican rise to power since the 1980s, recently said in a church to a group of Republicans.
How many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome? Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. In the meantime, Sean Hannity is suggesting Israel should drop a nuclear bomb to obliterate Hezbollah. I mean, the bottom line, when you pull all this stuff together, what has to do with the real federal deficit? I'm going to get to that in just a second. How is this connected to the never-ending war? How is that connected to
to ongoing suppression of voting. Well, it's all part of the same thing. It's all part of the conservatives trying to take us back and back to the worldview of the Victorian era, the worldview of fundamentally conservative economics. Thomas Frank has a piece today in the New York Times talking about just this very thing. He says you want to know where the Republicans are trying to take us right now. The conservatives are, and it's not just the Republicans; they're conservative Democrats as well who are doing this. Where they want to take us right now? Go back and look at the 1880s. Now, this is a point that I have been making for years in my writings and in my regular rants here. That this is all about taking us back to an economic era that was, in many ways, validated, at least in the minds of many people, by Charles Darwin. Darwin's cousin was an economist, and he was pushing this stuff really hard. Just the whole idea of survival of the fittest. The rich are rich because they are the most competent, therefore they are the most deserving. Most competent at what? Well, it doesn't matter. Don't look behind that screen. And so we have the situation where these different I played this clip of Bill Clinton in the beginning of the program saying that, you know, they believe that the strength of America is grounded in its institutions. I did play that clip, didn't I, David? I know I played it on our local program. This is what happens when you do two radio shows in a row. Which one did I play that on? Okay. This is the fundamental idea, is this idea that a nation is great because it has wealthy and powerful people. A nation is great because it has powerful institutions. Well, there's nothing wrong with wealthy and powerful people and powerful institutions in and of themselves. But the traditional view of America held by Americans since the founding of this country, and if you read the writings of the founders, it is very clear that the majority of them held this idea. A minority of them did not. You know, there were the Alexander Hamiltons and the John Adams among them who felt that we should have essentially a functional aristocracy. But Jefferson, Madison, Jay, George, Washington, they were strongly of the opinion that the strength of the country was a function of the strength of its middle class. That what the Bushes are all about, what the Cons are all about, is transferring the wealth from that middle class to an elite. And they really believe that that's the best thing for the nation. I mean, this isn't about people being evil. I mean, we can get into the whole war thing, and you could build a case there. But fundamentally, there's a rationale behind, there's a worldview behind the conservative worldview. There's a rationale that allows these folks to look at themselves in the mirror and to sleep well at night, because there's an intellectual and philosophical consistency to it all. They would point out, as Russell Kirk does in his probably the leading book of the 20th century, his book, his 1953 book, The Conservative Mind, the book that animated William F. Buckley, that got William F. Buckley started on the whole thing, the modern conservative movement, that woke up Barry Goldwater. I mean, all these guys talk about Russell Kirk. Kevin Phillips, in his new book, talks about Russell Kirk. I mean, it all goes back to 1953, The Conservative Mind. And Russell Kirk, in his book, goes back to Sir Edmund Burke. Back in the late 1790s, Thomas Paine went over to England and during the French Revolution and spent some time with Sir Edmund Burke, the leading conservative theoretician of the day. And they began a debate during the 2 weeks that Paine stayed at Burke's house that so angered Thomas Paine that he wrote an entire book in rebuttal of Edmund Burke. It's called The Rights of Man, in which he suggested that there should be a social security system. He suggested there should be unemployment insurance. He suggested that there should be social welfare programs independent of churches so that they're secular, so that there's a social safety net, that there should be, you know, that there the health care for all, that there should be a progressive income tax. I mean, Thomas Paine laid out the first liberal agenda because that was the worldview of many people of that time. And Burke, on the other hand, said, and now I'm doing this from memory, so I'm sure this isn't word for word, but it's awful close. He says, it does me no harm if a man engaged in as servile a profession as that of hairdresser or tallow maker, candle maker, is allowed to pursue his profession. But it does society considerable harm if such a man is allowed to participate in governance, in other words, to vote or to run for public office. Because they really believe that you have to have a governing elite. Because they really believe that that produces the most stable form of government. And if you look at government over thousands of years, over the 6,000-7,000 years of the history of civilization, you can find long periods of great stability where there were governing elites. The Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, all the way back to Gilgamesh, all going 7,000 years. Now, you'll also find that these periods are punctuated by warfare, they're punctuated by upheavals. Now, you could just as easily make the case that it doesn't provide for stability, but that's not the side of it that the conservatives look at. They say, no, this is what makes for stability. And so it's a perfectly appropriate and healthy thing to transfer wealth from the middle class to the very wealthy. In fact, the conservatives would tell you, particularly the neoconservatives, the new conservatives, particularly those who came of age in the 60s, going back to the teachings of Leo Strauss, the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, the University of Chicago, they looked at what happened in America when the middle class reached its peak, its historic peak. The middle class in the United States in the 1960s was about as wealthy and powerful as the middle class was around the time this country was founded. And that led to a revolution in the 1770s. What? A strong middle class? Revolution. And in the 1960s, a strong middle class. People had job security. They had health insurance. They had unemployment insurance. They, if you could get out to California, you could go to college for free. I mean, it was just, people were not afraid. And so what did they do? They stood up and they spoke out. They talked back to government. They spoke their mind. You know, African Americans were saying, we want all our rights, thank you very much. Women were saying, we want rights too. We want to participate in this. And the conservatives looked at this and said, oh, my God, this is a prescription for social disaster. We can't have this. And so starting in 1981, Ronald Reagan declared war on the middle class. There is a plan to destroy, economically, to destroy the middle class, to reduce the middle class into the high end of the working poor. Why? Because a middle class will talk back, and conservatives don't like that. It's not just that they don't like it. They fear it. They think that it's unstable. They look at the riots in the 1970s in the inner cities. They look at the peace movement. They look at the free love movement, and they say, those were signs of social decay. And that's what happens when you have a strong middle class. So we can't allow that to happen again, which is why we have two sets of federal books, which we'll get to in a few minutes. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm going crazy, little every day. And everything I wanted is now driving me away. I wake this morning to the sound of breaking hearts. Mine is full of questions and it's tearing yours apart, tearing yours apart.
All right, welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Talk radio for the rest of us. Tom Hartman radio program and Victoria Jones with Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, our official senior waiting for Verizon correspondent on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Waiting for Verizon?
I've got no signal on my home phone, so I'm stuck here. And the window they gave me, if you can believe this, between which they will come, is 8 and 6.
Hi. You have, by no signal, you mean no dial tone?
No dial tone.
So your phone is dead. So you're having to use your cell phone.
Having to use a cell phone.
Yeah.
And between 8 and 6, 10 hours.
Well, that's interesting.
It's appalling.
It is. It really is. I guess that's what happens when you have a monopoly. I remember when I lived in Vermont, there was this little Vermont company, a little local Vermont company. I'm trying to remember the name of it. It was just great. I had telephone service through them. I had internet service through them, and their phone rates were just very simple. You know, it was like $25 a month, and you know, gets you five basic things, you know, or whatever it was. I mean, I don't remember the details of it, but it was just very simple, very straightforward. No gotchas. No, you know, we pay for this and we get that, but you got to have this. All these funny things, and they were very competitive. And I believe it was Verizon owned the cable, you know, owned the copper in Vermont, and they were trying to get a law passed saying that they didn't have to lease copper to this company. And the copper's on the rights of way. I mean, you know, this copper, the phone lines run along our roads that are maintained by we the people. This is public property that these phone companies are running this copper on. And so I think that they should be required to allow competition. And we did have that in Verizon in Vermont. And I think it improved the service of both companies. But it sounds like you don't. You only have one choice of phone companies.
Pretty much. There's really no choice. Maybe there's a teeny weeny company, but they don't have any access to anything as far as I'm aware. There's no choice.
Yeah. And that's welcome to America in the 21st
century.
Yeah,
welcome to. And you know, when I first came here as an immigrant, and I, you know, got off the boat and went to the Statue of Liberty and all those great things, I thought everything was about competition. That's what I thought America was. And then my very first sign up was with AT&T, and I just discovered that, oh, so they have a monopoly.
Yes.
Oh, it's fun.
Yes, Lily Tomlin, you know, we're the phone company. We don't care what you think. Oh, my. Well, I'm sorry to hear that you're not happy with your telephone company, Victoria Jones. But
it's really a no big interest or concern to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
I understand that.
Actually, I've been riffing on this thing for the last 15, 20 minutes here about the corporate elites and you know, the whole conservative mindset. So it was a perfect segue, actually. Now to the news.
Yes, sir.
Okay, what's happening in the world?
Well, the president is zooming around today, spending 5 or 6 hours, which is an awful lot of scheduled time for a president, at the National Counterterrorism Center in McLean, Virginia, meeting with the National Security Council, with workers at the National Counterterrorism Center. He made a statement there. He's meeting with his Homeland Security team. He's met with the Secretary of Defense and others. In his statement, of course, he talked about the fine work of those at this counterterrorism center, and he managed to tie it all in, of course, to the work undertaken to uncover the plot in London. In fact, he did manage to say he managed to bring America into this plot uncovering somehow, because we had nothing to do with it.
Mm.
Recently, we saw the fruits of their labor in conjunction with their counterparts in Great Britain.
Now, this is interesting. Did you by any chance watch Countdown with Keith Olbermann last night?
I did, until I fell asleep, yes. And
did
I did watch the linkage. Yes, I watched all that.
Yeah, where he went through every single time the Bush administration was getting really, really bad press, they would pull some newly discovered terror plot out of the hat. And here, and in fact, if you go to the website, they're up to like 13 of them now, where you know, the Bushies are getting bad press, and within 2-3 days, bingo, terror plot, terror alert, and then later, you know, weeks later, we discover, it really wasn't, or Bush manipulated the timing on the thing. And I'm getting very concerned about, you know, we're coming up to an election, and we saw, you know, Tom Ridge is now complaining out loud about how Bush was making him raise the terror levels and to jack around the 2004 election and keep Kerry from getting good publicity. And I'm really concerned that they're going to use something, or maybe allow something really bad to happen between now and November.
I don't know that they will go as far as to allow something bad to happen. I'm not prepared to go that far, but I am certainly concerned that an excess of caution might take place and that the terror level might be raised.
Yeah, that they'll do the PR stuff if not. I'm just wondering, is Bush getting more presidential daily directives that say, you know, Bin Laden determined a strike in the U.S., and he's going, okay, thank you very much. That's just what we need.
Oh, my God, that's too terrifying.
I am really getting that cynical, Victoria, I got to tell you. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. I know your job is to be the reporter, so I'll be the cynic. Thanks, Victoria.
Okay.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Hello, trouble. Come on in. You talk about heartaches. Where in the world you been? I ain't had the mysteries since you've been gone. Hello, trouble, trouble, trouble. Welcome home.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. All things iPod, all things Macintosh, smalldog.com. They have PC stuff there as well. What's the real federal deficit? I have to tell you about this before I go to your phone calls here. Make my point, right? I'm just going to read this straight up. I'll play reporter for a moment, or I'll share with you, actually, Dennis Kaushin, a reporter for USA Today, he wrote this piece. This is what the headline, What's the Real Federal Deficit? And here's the story. Straight up, starting with the first sentence from USA Today, the federal government keeps two sets of books. The set the government promotes to the public has a healthier bottom line, a $318 billion deficit in 2005. The set the government doesn't talk about is the audited financial statement produced by the government's accountants following standard accounting rules. It reports a more ominous financial picture, a $760 billion deficit for 2005. If Social Security and Medicare were included, as the board that sets accounting rules is considering, the federal deficit would have been $3.5 trillion. That's $3,500 billion. Congress has written its own accounting rules, which would be illegal for a corporation to use because they ignore important costs such as the growing expense of retirement benefits for civil servants and military personnel. Last year, the audited statement produced by the accountants said the government ran a deficit equal to $6,700 for every American household. That's 1 year's deficit. The number given to the public put the deficit at $2,800 per household. Pretty mind-boggling, huh? And this isn't, by the way, unique to the Bush administration. This has been going on for a long time. And people starting to say, wait a minute, something's wrong here. And is Bush going to use war, an unending war, to try and promote this thing? I mean, this is not an idea or a concern that began with George Orwell when he wrote his book 1984. In fact, on April 20th, 1795, a distant ancestor of mine, James Madison, wrote in his book Political Observations, or his little pamphlet, actually, he said, of all the enemies of true liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes, and armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. In war, too, the discretionary power of the president is extended. His influence in dealing out offices, honors, and emoluments is multiplied, and all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. Keep in mind, this is James Madison, fourth president of the United States, the father of the Constitution. The same malignant aspect, he writes, in republicanism may be traced to the inequalities of fortunes, the opportunities of fraud growing out of a state of war, and in the degeneracy of manner and of morals engendered in both. No nation. Said our nation's fourth president and the father of our Constitution. No nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. War is, in fact, the true nurse of executive aggrandizement. executive branch, the president. In war, a physical force is to be created, and it is the executive will which is to direct it. In other words, the president is in charge. In war, the public treasuries are to be unlocked, and it is the executive hand, the president's hand, which is to dispense them. In war, the honors and emoluments of office are to be multiplied, and it is the executive patronage, that is the discretion of the president, under which they are to be enjoyed, and it is the executive brow they are to encircle. Keep in mind, he says executive here. He's talking about the executive branch of government, the presidency. The strongest passions and the most dangerous weaknesses of the human breast. Ambition, avarice, vanity, the honorable or venal love of fame are all in conspiracy against the desire and duty of peace. And here it is. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, John in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, a basic question that the American people have to be asked, Tom, is do you want an aristocracy or the people to be in control?
This is the reason why Limbaugh for 15 years has been promoting the meme of liberal elites, because what conservatives are really about is an elite aristocracy. And if you want to neutralize somebody from labeling you, you label them first with the exact same label. It's the reason why Bush is using the word fascism right now to describe Islamists, to describe Muslims, when in fact fascism is the merging of corporate and state interests, which is the very business that Bush is engaged in.
You got it. Now, the Democrats that you want to see succeed, and I'm for any group that will do this, have to make that move.
Make which move? Okay. To ask the people to want an aristocracy?
The move to confront the American public with the realization of where we are versus where we should be based on a U.S. Constitution.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the problem is, you know, during the Reagan era, during the 1980s, the conservatives got on their high horse about liberal teachers and liberals in the schools and liberal textbooks, and they basically purged our schools of the teaching of civics. So, you know, that in fact, there was a famous study that was done back during the Vietnam War where in Washington, D.C., people, you know, just passersby were asked to sign a copy of the Declaration of Independence, and the majority of them refused to, said, you know, this is a communist document or it's a subversive document. And so now we have probably the last two generations, I'd say, if a generation is 20 years, at least the last generation, that are not familiar with the history of this country, the true history of this country, and basically just know what they've learned from Ronald Reagan and the conservatives since him, and from the conservative media, the corporate-owned media, and the conservative talk show hosts. And I'm not sure that they would get your question, John.
Well, you know, I think that a political party in power, like the Democrats, needs to take a look at asking that question.
Yeah,
and they probably won't, because so many of them, DLC, as you have mentioned, are a part of that whole deal.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Hanging along.
Yep. John, thanks a lot for the call. You're absolutely right. I agree with you. In fact, here's Bill Clinton. He was on Good Morning America, ABC's Good Morning America program, and he's asked, about Joe Lieberman here, and he makes a very important point at the end.
Joe Lieberman said that this was basically liberals in the party purging moderates such as him and you out of the party, and that there needs to be a voice for more moderate national security voices.
Well, if I were Joe and I were running as an independent, that's what I'd say too, but that's not quite right. That is, there were almost no Democrats who agreed with his position, which was, I want to attack Iraq, whether or not they have weapons of mass destruction. And his position was the Bush-Cheney-Rumsfeld position.
Joe Lieberman's position was the Bush-Cheney-Rumsfeld position, and there were almost no Democrats on that side saying, go ahead and attack. The Democrats who voted in the Senate for the war resolution were actually just trying to, they thought they were giving the president the power to use war as a threat to encourage negotiation. And in fact, the majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives, this is a fact that is real, indisputable, reported in the newspapers, and yet you'll never, you know, most people don't even know it, because the right-wing talk show hosts constantly point out, the majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives voted against the war resolution to go into Iraq in the first place. The majority of Democrats voted against giving the president that power. And yet you constantly hear Republicans and conservatives and corporate media types going, well, the Democrats voted for this. No, they didn't. In the Senate, the majority of Democrats did, but not in the House of Representatives. And those who did in the Senate, most of them have recanted now. John Kerry, John Edwards, they've come back and they said, we never should have made that vote. Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia.
Hey, Tom. Tom, you know, something that's puzzling to me about the conservative ideology is I always thought that what makes sense to me now is that if you take poor people out of poverty, you bring them into the middle class, and then you keep the middle class strong, don't you there have a large consumer base? You know, it's like you look at Mexico. What's the point of having all those poor people and there's a few that are rich? You know, you bring people...
Well, it depends on who you are. I mean, if you're one of the few who are rich, the point is, hey, life's good.
Yeah, but don't you become richer? I mean, let me give you an example. Down the street, I have some car dealerships, and then maybe 2 miles down the road, there's a huge mall near my house. Who's going to shop there if we don't have spending money? I mean, we know middle-class people spend. Those are the people that buy.
Well, they want there to be essentially what might be referred to as a lower middle class, economically speaking. That is, people who are... They have enough money that the economy can keep moving. They have enough money that they can pay taxes, that they can carry the load for the country. But they don't have enough security, and they don't have enough money that they can step out and be uppity.
Well,
when you look back at the 60s and 70s, that was the golden age of the American middle class. From the 1950s until the 1980s, the middle class in America had more economic power than it has ever had before. And what did they do? They used that. They used that freedom to stand up and say, no, we're going to speak out. And the conservatives say, no, we can't have that. We can't have an uppity middle class. Are you kidding? We don't want people speaking out. So that's what it's about. They want basically a large number of working poor, Patricia. Thanks a lot for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Some you just can't tell. And some they will and some they won't. And some it's just as well. You laugh at my behavior, and that'll never bother me. Say the devil is my savior, but I don't pay no heed. And I will go out shining, you shine a light from you. I'll never look behind you, my troubles will be few.
And welcome back. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The place where we dare to ask the questions the mainstream media are generally afraid of. Indeed. 1-866-440-8466, our phone number. Chris in Long Beach, California. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Great to talk to you.
Thank you.
You know, I really love it when you talk about Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine, and I have a, because I'm an avid fan of history, and I always learn a lot from your program. I think you ought to write a book with a parallel biography of Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine, because I just love to learn more about them.
Well, there's a couple chapters about them in the book that I have coming out this fall called Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the American Middle Class.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. Also, I have a book recommendation for your wise listeners and a video. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They can get free. The book is called The Right to Vote by Alexander Kesar. I don't know if you've read that particular book.
I have not.
Okay. It's quite fascinating. It traces the history of voting from the founders' time all the way up to the present and how it's not necessarily right, you know.
No, that's what the Bush v. Gore decision was. The Supreme
exactly.
Court ruled that we do not have the right to vote for President of the United States. It's not in the Constitution.
Yeah, and the other thing is, and they can get it free if they go to archive.org, just type in The Power of Nightmares.
Oh, yeah.
And you can get that series for free. Just watch it on their computer or burn it onto DVD.
Yeah, Adam Curtis's brilliant, brilliant BBC series, which...
I learned so much from that.
Oh, it's incredible. It is the history of the neocon movement and the history of Al-Qaeda and the parallel history, how these two are symbiotic, and it's absolutely incredible. You're absolutely right. It's the power of nightmares, and I've seen it over at informationclearinghouse.info. You said it's at what?
Archive.org. They broadcast everything that's in the public domain, and Adam Curtis was nice enough to allow it to be posted. So they just go to www.archive.org and just type in Power of Nightmares.
That's great.
And they can download it.
Everybody should watch that. It is incredible. It's three 1-hour pieces, and it's like taking the red pill. I mean, you literally, your worldview has changed after you've seen it. It's incredible.
Absolutely.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Joe in Brookings, Oregon on the line. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, it was interesting to hear you talk about the Bill Clinton, one of the most overrated windbags this country has ever seen. We learned in the last...
He was a pretty decent... I say he was probably the best Republican president we've had since Eisenhower.
Well, speaking of the best Republican president we ever had, we learned in the last week... that if correct accounting procedures had been used, we find out that there was no budget surplus under Bill Clinton. There was a huge deficit.
It was about a $400 billion deficit if it's done right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody was sitting around talking about how are we going to spend the surplus.
Democrats
and Republicans.
Peter DeFazio brought that up himself. I remember talking about it all the time during the 90s. And
Pete DeFazio was pointing out is that there is no surplus,
mm-hmm.
and that the government is cooking the books. And Peter DeFazio has been right at the front of this thing, and he's a really good guy.
And about Clinton talking about Lieberman, it's funny. Clinton says he said when he comes out and endorsed Lieberman, he said, well, the war issue isn't really that big an issue, and you can't knock a guy like Lieberman out of the box over one issue, even though Lieberman is so terrible.
But see, I got that, Joe. But to his credit, what Clinton did, and thank you very much for calling. To his credit, Clinton. I mean, on the one hand, he endorsed Lieberman when Lieberman was running as a Democrat, as an incumbent Democratic senator in a Democratic primary. And, you can like that or not. And when I said, Clinton's the best Republican president we had, Clinton as a Democrat did a lot of good things. He was particularly good for the environment. And economically, in some ways, he was good. I have a real problem with the signing of the Telecommunications Act of 1996 and with his pushing for NAFTA and GATT and getting those pushed through Congress. I just have a real problem with it. But, I can't find a president I don't have some problem with. I mean, FDR locked up the Japanese. I mean, there is no such thing as a perfect president. Clinton did a very, very good job. And when you compare him to W, he did a brilliant job. But the point that Clinton is making is that Lieberman was one of, he was along with the Democrats voting in favor of the war, but his reason was different. He wasn't trying to give Bush the power to negotiate, giving him a stick to negotiate with. He was a believer in regime change. Let's overthrow Saddam Hussein, no matter what's there, and continues to be in that position. And I think that that's just wrong. I'm very glad that Ned Lamont has beat him. I was a supporter of Ned Lamont. So we had him on this program a number of times, and God bless him in the fall. JR in Vancouver. Hey, JR, we just have a few seconds left. What's up?
Okay, I'll make this quick. I think the pharmaceutical issue and the FDA issue is important. I think that if the government were to allow automakers to put a disclaimer on safety issues such as airbags and seatbelts stating that they might work, that wouldn't fly, and that would never happen. I think that as far as the pharmaceutical companies go, that a disclaimer stating that certain things might happen is not good enough, and I think they should be held responsible for side effects.
Interesting. Well, in a way, the FDA, and thank you, JR, for the call, what the FDA does, what regulation does, is it allows companies to avoid liability in the marketplace, because they can say, well, we're regulated. You can't sue us for that. It's legal. That's an interesting point. 56 minutes past the hour. The IRS wouldn't hand out your personal information, would they? Colleen Kelly will be with us next to explain how they just may. They just may. To the guy down the street. You never know. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio. You ever encountered an insurance salesman or any kind of commissioned salesman? And you get the pitch, you know, and you get the, you should do this, you should do that, you should think about this. Used cars, yeah. I mean, do you want your taxes being collected by people who are being paid commissions to do it? As much as 24%? And particularly a private company that gets to know all about you, all about your private confidential information? Colleen Kelly is with us. She's the president of National Treasury Employees Union, NTEU. IRSWatch.org, the website, NTEU, like National Treasury Employees Union, IRSWatch.org. Colleen Kelly, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
Glad to have you with us. Is the scenario that I just described actually on the horizon?
Unfortunately, it is on the horizon, and it will begin on August 31st, according to a memo that the IRS just put out.
They're outsourcing the collection of taxes?
Yes, for the first time, the federal tax collection work will be done on a commission basis and not done by IRS employees. It will be done by private collection agencies.
That's incredible. I mean, we have been collecting taxes in the United States since this country was founded. It was principally tariffs up until the Civil War. We had a personal income tax from, I believe it was 1863 to 1871, was it, or something like that. Anyhow, there's a short period there where we had a federal income tax, and then it came back after around World War One. But it has always been done by government employees operating in confidence, answerable to elected officials who are answerable to us.
That's right.
And now it's going to be done by Acme Collection Service, who hires Igor down the street not to make it an ethnic slur or something, but just, you know, the idea of some guy, the repo man. This is spooky.
Yes, and it is going to happen in spite of congressional opposition that is mounting in opposition to this. And in spite of that, the IRS says they are going to turn over the first 40,000 taxpayer files to three of these private collection agencies on August 31st. And that's after they acknowledge, as well as the IRS acknowledges, that no one can do this work more efficiently than IRS employees. The IRS commissioner himself, in testimony before Congress, has said that this will be a very costly venture. It will cost taxpayers much more to have this work done on the commission basis, up to 24%, as you said, than it would to have IRS employees do this work.
So why are they doing it?
Well,
ideology.
They will tell you that they are doing it because they have a lot of collection work that is not being done because they do not have the funding to hire the staff that they need. And the fact is, this is about staffing. The IRS does need additional funding to hire employees to do this work, employees who are accountable, who, as you said, keep this information confidential, take this part of their job and the taxpayer rights issues very, very seriously. And that is the issue. There are not enough IRS employees, and rather than go to Congress and say, we need more funding and we need more staffing to collect these taxes, they have chosen to turn this work over to these collection agencies, pay them this bounty of up to 24%, and put this private and personal tax information in the hands of these collection agencies, which is not who America's taxpayers intend to have their information when they file their tax returns.
We're talking with Colleen Kelly, the president of the National Treasury Employees Union. NTEU, IRSWatch.org is their website. Colleen Kelly, I'm guessing, correct me if I'm wrong, or maybe it's something that I can say you can't, I don't know. But I'm guessing that the anti-union ideology of the Bush administration, I mean, this ever since Ronald Reagan declared war on organized labor in 1981, It's been pretty much unrelenting. I mean, there was a breather during the Clinton administration, although Bill Clinton actually reduced the size of our federal government by about 300,000 employees. But the anti-union sentiments are probably one of the driving forces of this. You hire private companies that don't have employees who are unionized.
Absolutely. It is anti-union. And it's also, and probably more importantly for taxpayers across the country, it's really anti-employee. This administration has made clear that they would like to contract out as much work of the federal government as possible to private contractors. They do not want the work of the federal government done by America's government employees, and that's
so
who should be doing this work.
And they do it under the rubric of making government smaller, but it's going to cost us more. More of our tax dollars are going to go to these private corporations because, you know, they're getting this 24% commission. I mean, we're going to be paying the salaries of CEOs of collection companies that are making millions of bucks a year as salaries. We're going to be paying for their advertising, their marketing, their promotion, their travel. This is crazy.
It is, and it is not a good use of the tax dollars that are paid by America's taxpayers. This work can and should be done by IRS employees at a much less of a cost, a more appropriate cost, and with those who take seriously the taxpayer rights issues around privacy and confidentiality.
Now, this seems to me like politicization of the Internal Revenue Service. I mean, this follows on the heels. I believe the last time we talked, Colleen Kelly, we were talking about how the IRS was going to lay off people who are looking into wealthy people evading their taxes. I guess that got enough publicity that they backed away from that.
Well, they have slowed down. They have not totally backed away, but they have not moved forward as fast as they said they would. It is still very much a real issue, though, to cut the workforce of those who examine the estate tax returns. Tom, you're right.
Yeah, incredible, incredible. What can, Colleen Kelly, what can we do about this?
What taxpayers can do is to contact their U.S. senators. There is already language passed by the House of Representatives that would stop the IRS from being able to move forward with this. They would not be allowed to spend taxpayers' money, appropriated funds, to do this. But we need the Senate to take the same action. So contacting your U.S. senators, telling them you do not want your tax information put in the hands of anyone other than the IRS and IRS employees. And also, as you mentioned, Tom, our NTEU IRS Watch website, where we are posting information regularly on this, because the IRS is not telling taxpayers that this is coming. They have not published any information or warned any taxpayers. If any taxpayers listening owe money to the IRS, I would strongly suggest you contact the IRS and tell them you want to make arrangements to pay the taxes so that your account is not turned over to a private collection agency.
NTEU, as in National Treasury Employees Union, IRSWatch.org is the website for more information. And you can call your United States Senator toll-free, the toll-free number for Capitol Hill. And you simply, if you're not sure who you're, each one of us has two senators, unless you live in Washington, D.C., in which case you can call anybody's senator. Even though they don't actually represent you, that's a whole other thing. But if you're not sure who your senators are, just you call and tell them what state you live in, and they'll tell you who your senators are, and just ask for their office and you know, be polite and just say, I don't want the IRS outsourcing the collection of taxes. And the toll-free number is 1-888-355-3588. That'll get you to Capitol Hill, to the Capitol Hill switchboard, the operators, you know, for the House and Senate. 1-888-355-3588. And that toll-free number is also on my homepage at tomhartman.com. And more information at NTEUIRSWatch.org. Colleen Kelly, anything else on the horizon, President of the National Treasury Employees Union, that we should know about, that any other surprises the Bush administration has planned for us that you folks are working on?
Oh, I think if you look at all of the agencies and the inadequate funding they're being given, there is a very concerted effort on the part of this administration to cut the services that taxpayers depend on from their federal government, and also to put all of the work that taxpayers expect to be done by federal employees into the hands of these contractors. So I would never know what tomorrow might bring, Tom, with this administration.
Now, they tried. There was a pilot program of this outsourcing of the collection of IRS debts to private companies back in 1996.
Yes.
And the company that got the contract was calling people at 4 o'clock in the morning to harass them?
That's right. And the program, the pilot, was deemed to be a failure by all those in Congress, and they actually canceled a second pilot because of reports similar to what you just reported, Tom. They were violations of taxpayer rights, calling them outside of the authorized times, and also were borderline harassment. And that pilot was not based on a commission. So if there were taxpayer rights violations under that pilot, you can just imagine what it will be like when their commission or their payment is based on what they collect. Because the last time I checked, 24% of zero is zero. So if they don't collect anything, they will not be getting paid. And that is going to invite very aggressive and inappropriate and overzealous collection tactics on their part, in my opinion.
We're talking bounty hunters here.
Yes.
Colleen Kelly, she's the president of the National Treasury Employees Union, the website NTEU, irswatch.org. Check it out. All right, and call your senators, 1-888-355-3588, and let them know you don't want the IRS outsourcing your tax information to anybody. Colleen Kelly, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Great speaking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where being progressive never felt so good.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our phone number, 1-866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com will get you there. Just click live chat up in the right, pretty much the middle of the top of the page there, and drop by our message board as well, our blogs, and you'll find archives of the program there, the whole thing over at tomhartman.com. You scroll down the page, you can find some of the books that I've written if you have any interest. Right now, let's check out what's going on with the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance.
Following our security incidents in Iraq, reported as of Tuesday, 10:15 GMT, by Reuters. Dateline Mosul, a suicide bomber detonated a truck rigged with explosives outside the offices of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan in that city, killing 9 people and wounding 36. 5 Kurdish Peshmerga militias were among the dead. In Bakaba, 1 policeman was killed and 3 people were wounded, including 1 civilian, when a roadside bomb targeting a police patrol exploded in a bus garage. In Huaydar, a roadside bomb targeting a police patrol exploded in that city, wounding 3 policemen. In Bakaba, a gunman shot dead police lieutenant Fadil Uthman while he was boarding a car in that town. In Baghdad, Iraqi security forces detained 48 suspected insurgents over the last 24 hours. In Muqdisho, gunmen killed 3 bakers supplying bread for the Iraqi army and wounded a passerby. In Samarra, 5 civilians were wounded when gunmen in a car shot at shoppers in a market in the center of that town. Near Dujail, gunmen shot dead a former Iraqi army officer on Monday night in a highway near that city. And in Samarra, 2 roadside bombs targeting police commandos exploded near the spiral minaret of Samarra, north of Baghdad, wounding 3 police commandos and destroying at least 1 vehicle, a joint U.S. and Iraqi police center said. This is the day of, or the day after, depending on how you count it. Today, the 15th of August, of the surrender of the Japanese. Arguably, yesterday was the 14th because MacArthur signed the papers on that side of the international dateline over toward Japan. So, you know, it's typically celebrated yesterday on the 14th. It can also be, but it was the 15th here in the United States on that day, and so there's always been a little, you could take it either way. And I think it's important for us to remember that while George W. Bush wants to be a war president so badly, and he just, he wants a war so bad. No.
I'm not making this up.
No, we're not. No, I'm not making this up. No. And he, in fact, keep in mind his famous.
That when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
Yeah, see, he thinks that war is what causes peace. Not feeding people, not educating people, not building a middle class, not creating economic security. No, war is what brings about peace. Just like he thought killing people would make Texas secure, which is why he was so proud of the fact that he had executed more people as governor of Texas than any other governor in the United States, in any other state, in the history, in the 230-year history of this country. He really believes that if you kill people who are misbehaving or behaving badly or doing bad things or are, in to use his lexicon, evil, as Bush said.
Either with us or against us. You're either evil or you're good.
I mean, if you really believe that, the people are either evil or good, then the only option if somebody is born evil in the mind of George W. is kill them. So here he is, he so wants to have this war because you get this incredible presidential power. That, I read you the quote from James Madison a little earlier. I think it's useful on this anniversary of the end of the war in the Pacific, the war against Japan, to remember what, they were really up to.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
But that was just the beginning, as Roosevelt pointed out. Actually, I'm going to have to share the rest of this with you when I come back. I thought I had a minute here to do it. But Roosevelt points out that it wasn't just Pearl Harbor that started World War II. And when Bush keeps trying to go back to 9/11, there are some real stark differences. And I'm sorry, George W. Bush is not a war president. He's an invasion president. He has created a war. I'll explain when I come back. There's just a little more to this than the story that as it's being portrayed in the mainstream media. It's 27 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. For a change.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, we were talking about George W. Bush wanting so badly to have a war. So the Project for a New American Century back in 1996 saying that we need a Pearl Harbor event in order to stimulate the American people in such a way that they'd be willing to put up with an invasion of Iraq. That George W. Bush's brother brother Jeb signed off on this thing, as did Wolfowitz and as did Cheney and as did Rumsfeld, Feith. I mean, the list goes on and on. All these PNAC guys. NewAmericanCentury.org. You can read the document. We need a new Pearl Harbor. And then George August of 2001. He's made Dick Cheney in charge. He's put Dick Cheney in charge of the Counterterrorism Task Force, which doesn't meet until September of 2001. Even after Richard Clark, they've you know, canned Richard Clark for all practical purposes. They've fired John O'Neill, or he's gone. He's off to work at the World Trade Center. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And they're getting all these warnings. There's something coming. It's going to be something big. Are they thinking, oh, this could be the Pearl Harbor we need? I'm beginning to think so. The more the two heads of the 9/11 Commission, Republican former New Jersey Governor Tom Keene and Tim Romer, the Democratic congressman, the two co-chairmen of the 9/11 Commission have now come out with a book about how Condoleezza Rice lied to them, about how the Bush administration lied to them, not just left stuff out, lied to them about 9/11, what happened on 9/11, how NORAD was not notified, the jets weren't scrambled, things like that. I just have to think, I'm not suggesting, I know some folks go so far as to say the Bush administration was behind 9/11. I personally don't think that. Or at least I'm not willing to go there. Let's just put it that way. Even in my own mind, I'm not willing to go there. It might just be some sort of psychological defense mechanism. I'm sure the Germans didn't want to believe that Hitler had anything to do with the Reichstag fire. But where I am getting very close to right now, and I think a lot of Americans are, particularly those who are looking at what has happened, is that, you know, when Bush was given that memo on August 6th, 2001, that said Bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States, and the CIA flew a guy down to Crawford, Texas, to personally deliver that message to him. Unprecedented. Essentially, this guy's job was to go down and say to the president, "Hitler coming!" And Bush says to him, "Okay, thanks a lot. You've covered your ass. Now go back to Washington, D.C. I mean, that's a literal quote. I'm not using gratuitous vulgarity here. That's the phrase Bush used. It's on the public record. And sends him back. And I apologize if I've offended you with it. And you just have to think, could it be that he's waiting for his Pearl Harbor? Because he knew, this is August of 2001, he knew within a month and a half that the New York Times, the Washington Post, USA Today, AP were going to publish a report showing that they had counted the actual vote in Florida. Keep in mind, this is a guy who was made president by appointees to the Supreme Court who were put there by his father's administration, by Reagan and by Bush, Sr. There were grumblings across the country that he was not a legitimate president. His largest political donor of his lifetime, Ken Lay, was on the verge of collapsing and getting into trouble. It's going to come out in the press in the next month or so that he actually lost the election in Florida, that when you count all the votes in the state, Al Gore actually won. He's going to be in terrible trouble politically. And then he hears, hey, there's some hijackers coming to take out the World Trade Center or something. Probably didn't even know exactly what it would be. A Pearl Harbor event. So anyhow, back to the differences between on this celebration, as it were, of VJ Day. Here's Roosevelt, first of all, with the announcement.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Okay, now, as I said, There you go. Pearl Harbor, 9/11. And Bush is trying to say they're the same thing. And therefore, there's a war been declared against us. And I'd say, no, I'm sorry. It's bin Laden. He's been trying to get attention from us for a long time. The guy's a criminal. We need to take him out as a criminal. If you follow Bush's logic, where the terrorists are, let's bomb. Then we should be bombing London right now. Okay, but what else happened on that day as Roosevelt made that announcement? Pearl Harbor happened, and Roosevelt continues.
Yesterday, the Japanese government also launched an attack against Malaya. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Hong Kong. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Guam. Last night, Japanese forces attacked the Philippine Islands. Last night, the Japanese attacked Wake Island. And this morning, the Japanese attacked Midway Island.
There you go. It was a little different. It was a real war against a real state, not against a guy that we haven't even caught yet. And it's just getting to be altogether too weird for me. 1-866-44 and I'm frankly very concerned. We have another election coming. Keith Olbermann last night laid this stuff out on his Countdown radio program or television program. The odd coincidences. Every time Bush gets in trouble, suddenly there's a terror alert. May 18th, 2002, first president details of the presidential daily briefing are revealed. Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S. 2 days later, FBI Director Mueller says another terrorist attack is inevitable. The next day, the Department of Homeland Security issues warnings of attacks against railroads nationwide, New York City landmarks like the Brooklyn Bridge and the Statue of Liberty. I'm quoting from Keith Olbermann here. Number two, June 6, 2002, Colleen Rowley goes before the Senate. 4 days later, speaking from Russia, John Ashcroft talks about Jose Padilla being under arrest. By the way, Padilla's been in the bag for a month now. Coincidence number three, February 5, 2003, Secretary of State Powell tells his stories, which he has since now said were untruthful. Are in doubt. He lays this thing out. 2 days later, as anti-war demonstrations continue to take place around the globe, Homeland Security Secretary Ridge cites credible threats by Al-Qaeda and raises the terror alert level to orange. 3 days after that, Keith Olbermann writes, and it's said on the television, Fire Administrator David Paulison, who had become the acting head of FEMA after the Hurricane Katrina disaster, advises Americans to stock up on plastic sheeting and duct tape. Remember that? Number four, it just goes on. I mean, he's got 13 of them here now. It was 10 as of last October. Well, now it's way up from that. Joe in Anchorage, Alaska. Hey, Joe, we got about a minute before we've got to take a break. What's up?
Well, what's up is, I'm interested in the subject of 9/11 because my cousin Vincent was a fireman in the South Tower and was killed in the collapse. So I've been really focused on the evidence as it's available and, of course, the significance of that date. Cheney was running all of these simulated tests that confused NORAD. Now we know that NORAD had lied for 2 years to the commission. There's ample reason to reopen the commission. To let the firemen and the first responders and the eyewitnesses testify. They never testified. And pursue, you know, the famous Building 7 that everybody talks about because it's the real Achilles heel.
Right. How is it the three buildings fell when two buildings were hit by planes? And how about getting some testimony from Bush and from Cheney under oath?
Well, that's it. They came in holding hands and weren't sworn in.
It was in private, and one of the basic ground rules was that whenever Cheney drank water, Bush was not allowed to speak.
Well,
I'm just kidding about that part.
No, but I give a presentation every month here in Anchorage about the evidence and how it doesn't conform to the conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
I'll be doing one August 28th, but more importantly, September 11th. We're going to have a presentation up here. I'm getting an awful lot of audience, and I'm sure it's the same.
Joe, hang on. I want you to actually give a plug for that, because we're on the air live in Anchorage right now. We'll be right back. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
From the rice fields of the Mekong to the desert by the Gulf, we're winning hearts and minds. We're winning hearts and minds. From the Yankees to the Cowboys and the soldiers of the Lord, we're winning hearts and minds. We're winning hearts and minds. They can really feel our freedom as we roll into their town. And when they finally get it, they'll give thanks. They'll throw flowers on our tanks. From the death squads of Guatemala to the folks who brought the Shah, we're winning hearts and minds. We're winning hearts and minds.
And welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Or at least clean elections. Now, Salon.com documenting six states now where the Republicans are planning to steal the elections in 2006. It's just, they're laying it out there. You can check it out over at Salon.com. Anyhow, we were talking to Joe in Anchorage, Alaska. He's listening on KUDO, also the home of Rich McClear, a great guy. And Joe, you were talking about a regular media on 9/11, and knowing that you're on a local station there, I didn't want to pass up an opportunity for you to plug your event, and yet I had to take a break because we operate on a hard clock here. I couldn't stop it. So if you've got a website or you just want to say when and where, go for it.
Well, I appreciate that. We have a place called the Organic Oasis, which is a restaurant here in town, and Monday nights they have an opportunity available. So I took it for August 28th to give my August presentation, but then September 11th is on a Monday night. So at the Organic Oasis here in Anchorage, we're going to have another examination of the evidence. Tom, my career for the last 35 years has been to assist attorneys in the production of what they call demonstrative evidence, evidence that helps the jury understand an expert's testimony about why the wing of an airplane fell off, for example.
Right.
So I approach the evidence about September 11th from that standpoint, cross-examining the conspiracy theory that we have, which is what the government gave us, 19 fellows with box cutters did all of this. You compare that to the evidence of what really happened on 9/11. They could not have accomplished this. Those buildings, now we have experts in physics and in construction. We have people like Kevin Ryan, who was privy to some of the underwriters' laboratory tests of the steel in that building, and others, who show, as the firemen said in their statements after the buildings collapsed, there were no fires in the core of either tower number one or tower number two. Firemen had reached to the upper sky lobby at 78, and the problem was congestion. Firemen were going up with their equipment, and people were coming down to escape the building. The building was structurally sound, except for the bombs that were going off. Many of
you're in the controlled demolition school of theory.
They speak about the bombs. Even Oliver Stone's movie, which I don't think is particularly a good movie, but I went to see it because it does supposedly tell us about the World Trade Centers, and it doesn't. But the firemen hear the bombs, and he had to put them in the movie.
True.
I'm
agnostic on this, Joe. You're the researcher. I mean, I can tell you about the Kennedy assassination.
I understand
but,
that.
But I have not, and I make no pretense of having done the kind of research on this that really needs to be done. And so I honestly just don't know. Mind is open. But
we're looking for a real commission who will allow the testimony of the firemen. They were all gagged. and they didn't contribute to this. So the conclusions reached by the 9/11 Commission are faulty at best and downright misleading at worst. And now to have Keene and others come out with this very important statement about how they were lied to, which has been obscured.
It was obscured by this other story from England. That's right. The book came out, and Bush says, hey, quick, arrest those guys. And Blair says, but wait a minute. Where Scotland Yard says, we need this guy to do the dry run so that we can prove that he actually had intent so we can prosecute him in court. And Bush is like, I don't care about prosecuting him in court. I need some publicity now.
You say it much better than I do. I'll just tell you, I'll end with this. As far as Diebold goes, we're suing. The Democratic Party here has sued the Republican administration.
Yes. We covered that on this show.
Good enough.
Yeah.
And September 25th, we have an evidentiary hearing. I'll keep you posted.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom.
Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Casey in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Casey, what's on your mind today?
Hey, that was like the perfect lead into my call.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi.
I just want to call real quick. I got a chance to read your article, The 70s Terror Playbook.
Mm-hmm.
Tom, my mouth hit the floor. I'm like, what? Like, they did this before? The exact same thing.
Oh, yeah. The you're talking about Rumsfeld and Cheney back in the 70s. Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They kind of, in a weird way, remind me of...
The Committee for the Present Danger, they set the whole thing up. Rumsfeld testified before Congress that the Soviets had secret submarines, weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist. The CIA said, no, those weapons don't exist. Rumsfeld, see, that's proof that they're secret. Yeah.
And I'm like, they're big charades. They kind of remind me of those two guys that ran around the village to make everybody think that the king had clothes on.
Right.
Yeah, there's a couple of us standing around like, I think that fool's naked. So the more that we talk about things is great, but is anybody in Congress, do they remember that, like, this happened before?
I think certainly John Conyers does. I mean, there are some of the wise elders of Congress who have that institutional memory, and there are some who have probably been exposed to the history of Rumsfeld and Cheney. I mean, it's not a secret. You know, this is something.
Yeah, I'm so tired of their charades. And when you look at the facts, just like that man was saying, it's hard not to come to the conclusion they didn't care, or they knew and they helped, or whatever. They're still culpable.
Yeah. Bottom line is there is something going on that's a whole heck of a lot bigger than what we've been told. Casey, thank you very much for the call.
Thanks.
You are too. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot for the call. Coming up on tomorrow's program, a return to the duck and cover days of the Cold War with Jeffrey Feldman of the Frame Shop is open. And our Everything You Know segment, Matthew Albright is going to be here talking about life patents, the biggest swindle of the 21st century. Remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.